all good. I can be green. Green's a good color. My name is Susan Bellier. I'm the coordinator of a community food organization in Kingston called Lovin' Spoonful. And we work to increase the amount of healthy food available to everyone in Kingston. Look at that. Thank you. Hi, Jen. I knew you could. So I'm going to talk briefly about some of the work we do and some of the vision I have and that Loving Spoonful has for how we can move forward towards a more just and sustainable food system. Because I want to get to questions soon, because I think there have been some really interesting things raised here, and I think the panel is mostly on the same page. It'd be interesting to hear from everyone else, too. So we take a... there we go. So there's our mandate, and I encourage you all, if you're local people, to check out our website, and you can get involved in Loving Spoonful as well as a volunteer. We have lots and lots of work for everyone to do. These are pieces of our mandate, and I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time on our projects. These are some of what we do, just to give you an idea. So we take a very broad-based approach to community food security. We do food reclamation, that's getting perishable surplus food into the emergency meal sector. We promote Grow a Row, asking everybody to grow a little extra for donation to the meal programs and food banks. We worked to create Oak Street Garden, which is Kingston's biggest community garden, and it is the home of a lot of projects and programming as well as allotment plots. We're part of Urban Agriculture Kingston, part of the Community Harvest Working Group. We work in coalition with a lot of other organizations. We're all very small organizations. Working together allows us to leverage our meager resources to make things happen. Part of the Food Providers Networking Group, we've partnered with the City of Kingston on a community garden networking group, and we do education and outreach work as well in the schools, at university classrooms, different lectures. There's Pat. I've got Pat in there because Pat and her family are some of the pioneers of making local food available in Kingston for people. And certainly when I first moved to Kingston, which was maybe 17 years ago or something, there wasn't a lot of talk about local food, and the first thing that I knew about that had anything to do with local food was Desert Lake Gardens delivery service, where you could leave a basket. It seemed so small town. You could leave a basket by your back door, and they'd come and fill it up with the food that you ordered. I just thought that was the craziest thing. And so the local food movement is big here in Kingston. There's a lot of interest here and everywhere in the 100-mile diet, local food, sustainable organic farming practices, pastured pork, free-range chickens, and you know, beef raised without antibiotics. These are all big things in the food world. We know that locally grown food, food produced using more sustainable farming practices, it's been proven in lots of ways to be better for us as individuals, as communities, and better for our planet. But the conundrum is, how do we ensure that everyone has affordable access to healthy food and ensure that farmers are receiving fair compensation for their work? You can see this is a slide I used in Development Studies 100 course last year. So I've put a Devs 100 t-shirt on this kid. So there is a growing population in Kingston of low-income and otherwise marginalized people who just can't afford to eat, let alone afford to eat healthy, local, fresh food. Food banks and meal programs tell us that the demand just keeps on rising despite generous charitable support. And at the same time, Kingston area farmers, most farming families have to take off farm work just to get by. We can't feed everybody cheap food on the backs of the farmers. That's just not sustainable either. So how do we reconcile these two interests? Let me know if you figure that one out. That's the big question for the millennium. But the other question I have is this, and how do we create access to what Pat was talking about a bit, this new farm economy that's emerging, this new interest in local food, small businesses arising around local food, jobs, education, the skills and the knowledge about local food systems and why it's important to us, and how do we make that knowledge and those pieces of information accessible to everybody. So it's not just about making the food accessible, which is a certain kind of food security, but about making the control over the food system part of what we all share as individuals and as a community. So what it all comes back to, and this has been touched on by everybody, is the concept of universality, universal access to good food and universal access to the information about our local food system that will allow us to make good choices at the individual level, but also at the policy level. When we're electing new mayors and councillors in a couple of weeks, we can be thinking about these kind of questions. And the concept of universality is something that, as Debbie was referring to, has worked well in other spheres, right? We have public education, we have libraries, the best example of universal access to something that I can think of. Most food security projects, community food access projects, at least in Kingston and in most of Canada, maybe the world, target very specific groups, and they do it on a shoestring budget. I'm not here to slag food banks and meal programs. Most run as well as they can, given their resources and the policies that they're working within. But we have food banks that have means testing, right, to make sure that you're poor enough to warrant free food. They typically implement a reward system or a punishment system. If you miss a pickup, then you're not eligible for your next pickup. If you show up late or drunk or strung out, you show up without your ID, no food for you. Meal programs tend to be aimed at very specific populations, often defined geographically, and many food programs are housed within agencies that do the sorting in other ways. So if you attend meetings at this agency, you'll get a voucher to take to the grocery store for milk. But none of these programs are universally accessible to everybody. And as Debbie was saying, for every one person who does access some of the emergency meal food sector, Elaine tells us that there may be four who aren't, and that's a really high number. When we target populations with programs like these, we exclude big bunches of folks. And despite our best intention, typically we stigmatize. And I look at the food sharing project here in Kingston, which does get food and supplies for breakfast, lunch, and snacks into the schools. They estimate that they serve 3,700 kids daily in about 80 sites. But how the schools and the teachers administer this program seems to be up to the discretion and the skill at the teacher in negotiating who's hungry and who isn't. And I don't really know how the teachers are supposed to make sure food gets only to the kids who need it without making the process of asking for food embarrassing, humiliating. Middle-class kids are gently and discreetly chided for wanting or asking for the treats in that basket. Tricky business when my middle-class 10-year-old decides he doesn't want his hummus and carrots. He'd rather have that pudding cup that's sitting in the snack basket. And the teacher has to find a way to make that okay. So some of them set it up as a swap thing. You have to, it's some way of trying to make the food accessible to everybody in a kind of a way. But it's anarchy, really, and not in a good way. It's the bad kind of anarchy. I assume it happens all over the city every day. I only know about the schools that my kid's been in. But everybody knows, ultimately, that this free food is for the poor kids. And so if you're getting this food, then your family couldn't send you to school with enough food. And so ultimately, having a system that isn't just universal, everybody gets free lunch, everybody has access to this, is going to stigmatize the kids who need it. So clearly I support universal school lunches and all sorts of universal programs. And universality is complicated when it comes to food, because unlike a library, which we may need occasionally, food we all have to eat every day several times, and it's an expense and a set of policies that our current governments don't seem all that interested in attacking at a systemic level anyway, so piecemeal solutions. So what I want to talk about then is the potential for urban agriculture to be one piece of the puzzle that we can talk about as a way that can try to start to bridge some of the disconnect between everybody and their food systems. So urban agriculture both as a way of growing more food, but also as a way of sharing information and knowledge and a greater respect for and engagement with the food system. Urban agriculture is nothing new. From the victory gardens during World War I, family vegetable gardens in the backyards of my childhood, to the ebb and flow of interest in community gardens we've seen for the last 30 or 40 years, urban agriculture, which just means growing food within urban boundaries, has helped to feed people all over the world for a very long time. When we talk about the local food movement, we mostly think of Pat's Farm. We think of small multi-use farms outside the urban area with beautiful people leading a beautiful food-focused life with chickens and small children running around and kittens in the barn. And that is definitely the version of agriculture that speaks to our sense of some kind of Canadian heritage. There's Margaret Little, who grew up on a farm, too. And that's certainly a big part of the local food movement. But for the past several years here and in many other small and large urban centers around the world, we've been working on a messy and complicated process of trying to build an interconnected web of sustainable food system that bridges the urban and the rural. And in many cities, this has included significant moves towards growing at least some of our food within urban boundaries. And not surprisingly, many examples of this come from the global south. After all, cities in the developing world have been facing serious food crises for a long time. So here's a couple of pictures from one of my favorite cities, Havana, Cuba. Famous for its urban agriculture programs. Not always all they're cracked up to be, I think, but certainly miles ahead of what most major cities, and certainly major cities in developing countries, get to see. I won't go into the history of Havana and food. I won't go into the history of various cities in Brazil and food, another country that has seen a lot of interesting urban agriculture projects that have been really successful. But from Havana to Belo Horizonte to Bangladesh to sub-Saharan Africa, there's these enormous urban agriculture programs all over the world. And so what can we learn from this? Could this be part of an efficient way of at least partially feeding urban populations and also bringing the connectedness to food production into an urban population that seems to be more and more disconnected from food? So urban agriculture would look different in every city. Kingston's urban agriculture initiatives are going to look different again as we forge a path that suits our climate and geography, our history, and the needs and desires of our current population. Everyone has a different notion of what urban agriculture is, which became painfully clear a couple of years ago when a number of us were trying to work with the city to get language to support urban agriculture into the official plan for the city of Kingston. And one of the most difficult things was finding a definition of and examples of urban agriculture that didn't immediately send city council into a panic about, you know, chickens and goats taking over the city. That's what people go to immediately. And there is, you know, we are going to have chickens in Kingston pretty soon. But, and they may be as pretty as this one, too. I like this chicken. It's a good-looking chicken. But urban agriculture isn't just about chickens, and it's not just about community gardens, which is the other place that people think about, you know, groups of people coming together to grow food in individual allotment plots. These are some of the things that urban agriculture can include. And when you look at Kingston, the actual city of Kingston involves this enormous peri-urban space as well. So when we think about urban agriculture potential in Kingston, we have North America's largest, well, until very recently, productive agriculture space right in the city of Kingston with the prison farm, Frontenac Institution and Collins Bay Prison Farms is North America's biggest urban farm, not currently in production, but we all are very hopeful that it will be again. And then there's all these things. There's rooftops, there's greenhouses, there's aquaculture, right, growing, having fish in tanks. Certain kinds of fish seem to be well grown that way. There's small businesses. Pat was saying that, you know, the value, the added value products are what allow them to maintain their lifestyle and keep going. And so for them, it's added value products, but she was saying mushrooms as well. Right? We need to think about agriculture in a really big way. I don't think you grow corn in a city because it takes up a lot of space and doesn't have a ton of nutrient value for the amount of space it takes up. So you have to think about urban agriculture a little bit different. I don't think urban agriculture is a magic bullet, but I think it is one of the important strategies for engaging a really broad spectrum of the population in the local food movement. For generating jobs, even, you can have urban CSAs, you can have urban greenhouses, you can have all sorts of places where people can be trained in growing techniques, and in the technology that supports them, because, for example, greenhouses, there's a ton of new greenhouse technology that that is very technical and is going to require a lot of people having a lot of know-how about closed systems, closed-loop greenhouse systems, using the heat from compost systems to heat the greenhouse, using different ways of solar reflection, different kinds of high-tech materials. There's all sorts of things that could be really well done in an urban setting, especially Kingston with all our brownfields lands. It isn't going to be good for much else. So talking about greenhouses, I'm just going to give an example, one of my favorite urban agriculture examples. It's a project called Growing Power, and these greenhouses are located in Milwaukee. So, an environment, a geography not that different from ours in terms of seasons. Growing Power founder, director, and former pro basketball player, Will Allen, here, he purchased the last working farm in Milwaukee, and they run Growing Power with at-risk youth to provide employment and training and food for the local restaurant system. I think they might also run a CSA out of it. So they have a total of six greenhouses, growing over 12,000 pots of herbs, salad mix, beet greens, arugula, mustard, seedlings, sunflowers, and radish sprouts. They also host six aquaponic systems. So those are big tubs of mostly tilapia, I think. Tilapia and perch. And they filter their water from the aquaponics, gets used to water the plants throughout the greenhouse. It's a very, it's a fairly complex ecology that they have within these greenhouses. They have hoop houses growing a mixture of salad greens. They have a worm composting hoop house. They sell worm compost tea as one of their value-added products. So they dry worm compost, bag it, and sell it for house plants. They have an apiary with beehives. They have three poultry hoop houses with laying hens and ducks. They have outdoor pens for livestock, including goats, rabbits, and turkeys. And outside the city, they have a very large plot of land where they do sort of more significant composting that they then use within their greenhouses. They have a small retail store for selling produce, meat, worm castings, and compost. And they provide a lot of education. So there's a map of what they've got going on. So this isn't a community garden. This isn't, and I love community gardens, I really do. But I want us to think about urban agriculture as being actually is something that can be beyond what we usually think of. They do education, business planning, farming, and actually train kids who can then go off and work in the farm sector. which is another interesting spin-off of an urban agriculture project like this. So some of the ways that urban agriculture can work within a local food movement, and I'll just quickly go through this. I'm jumping over things so we can be done and have a conversation. But first, a big part of the local food movement is about education and consciousness raising. So teaching people where food comes from, what's healthy, the cycle from seed to soil to table, back to soil. And urban agriculture can do this by being way more accessible to way more people. School field trips, you can actually integrate things into the school curriculum. You can have projects that are right in schools or in neighborhoods that schools can access. It gives more people more access to the experience of growing food. Second, urban agriculture challenges some of our food miles issues and can virtually eliminate food miles as an issue. Not such a big deal in Kingston, where our farms are close by and we have a fairly robust agricultural economy within very few miles of Kingston. But in other centers, it's a bigger issue. Third, this is really underestimated, and I referred to this a moment ago. There is an emerging research and development sector in sustainable technologies, and urban agriculture uses a lot of these technologies. We have a program here at St. Lawrence College that trains people in some of these sustainable technologies, and I would like to see a partnered project between some kind of urban agriculture thing on a pretty sophisticated level with the program at St. Lawrence. We can be looking at vertical farming, which there have been a lot of proposals for. I think there's going to build a vertical farm in Las Vegas, of course, where else? Which is sort of a series of greenhouse pods on top of each other. There's a lot of, as we need to feed more and more people, there's just a lot of interesting technology that we're going to have to cope with, the same way as we are with energy now. Urban agriculture also really lends itself to social enterprise, which social enterprises are profit-making businesses that serve a social and or environmental need and typically funnel the profits back into a more charitable end of the business or into its own operations. Fair trade companies are a really good example of a social enterprise. But for urban agriculture, being located in urban areas mean they can take on training and employment of all sorts of marginalized groups in work that can be personally rewarding, healthy, educational, et cetera, and generate and be part of the economy. So Growing Power, one of the things they do is they rent herb plots to restaurants. So they grow herbs. They send the living herb to a restaurant in its pot. It gets harvested and used until it's kind of dead-looking. They send it back to the greenhouse. They revive it. They give them a new one. And so restaurants pay an annual fee to have this cycle of fresh herbs coming in and out of their restaurant. It's an interesting little model of something. We could be growing mushrooms in our sort of empty industrial park buildings. There's all sorts of things we could be doing. And the skills, as we learned in the prison farm debates, the skills that you learn in working in agriculture are transferable to all sorts of other kinds of jobs. So training, when we think about urban agriculture models as a place for training, there's a lot of potential there. So this is the social integration piece of it. Urban agriculture, it lends itself to an integrated work space because there's a lot of skill level, different skill levels, ability levels. You can have kids and adults, scientists and farmers, able-bodied and disabled bodies working cooperatively on a project that's feeding people and feeding the knowledge of the community. So urban ag isn't going to fix everything, just like universal school lunches won't fix everything. But I do think that embedding programs and projects like these in our everyday lives, in our schools, our workplaces, our communities, I think that's the way we can move forward in trying to make good food accessible to all.